Africa.
Hello there. Today is Monday, November 20th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Zimbabwe's embattled leader refuses to resign as thousands take to the streets to celebrate his removal.
They have helped us, so we are happy for them for what they did for us.
Another powerful earthquake strikes the South Pacific. What the top U.S. nuclear commander says about U.S. nukes. Also ahead, we talk to Dr. Jane Goodall and about her new documentary on her life and groundbreaking research. It's all on today's International Edition. Much-awaited televised address to the nation, Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe didn't resign on Sunday despite calls from his own party to do so. He said the events of the past week in Zimbabwe, including Wednesday's military takeover, are not a threat to the Constitution or his authority as head of state and commander-in-chief.
I, as the President of Zimbabwe and as their commander-in-chief, do acknowledge the issues they have drawn my attention to, and do believe that these were raised in the spirit of honesty and out of deep and patriotic concern for the stability of our nation and for the welfare of our people.
On Saturday, thousands of exuberant Zimbabwean demonstrators flooded the streets in the capital of Harare, some of whom marched toward the president's official residence amid nationwide protests calling for his resignation. Willard Barragina is looking forward to life after Mr. Mugabe.
We expect a bright future, especially for us young people. So many young people are well-educated but no jobs. We are just struggling, loitering around the town, so we expect a bright future for us.
The military has stopped such demonstrations in the capital in the past, but is now supporting the protests, directing demonstrators to the Zimbabwe grounds where speeches were made by activists, politicians, and former freedom fighters calling for the president to resign. The ruling party has given Mugabe until noon on Monday to resign or face impeachment. Southern African leaders will be discussing the ongoing political crisis in Zimbabwe at a meeting Tuesday of the Southern African Development Community in Angola. Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson advocated for a return to civilian rule in Zimbabwe. VOA correspondent Mariama Diallo reports on what happens next and where the country goes from here.
U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson says that ultimately the people of Zimbabwe must choose their government.
We all should work together for a quick return to civilian rule in that country in accordance with their constitution. Zimbabwe has an opportunity to set itself on a new path, one that must include democratic elections and respect for human rights.
Tillerson made those remarks on Friday to African ministers and diplomats before a meeting in Washington on trade, security, and governance.
In our conversations today, we have an opportunity to discuss concrete ways that we could help them through this transition.
President Robert Mugabe made his first public appearance at the university graduation ceremony on Friday since the country's military, which is not calling its actions a coup, took apparent control of Zimbabwe earlier in the week.
It has all the trappings of a coup when somebody comes on to state TV in a military uniform and says the president is safe and pretty much takes control of the political situation. It's a coup.
Jennifer Cook says while the military accomplished their first goal of stopping the purge of senior leaders from Mugabe's party, ZANU-PF, and preventing Grace Mugabe, the president's wife, from taking office, it's now unclear what their plan is.
I think the big uncertainty now, and you know, some people may be jubilating, but it's a little too soon for that, is what kind of transition is going to be put in place to an eventual election.
Mugabe has been Zimbabwe's president for nearly four decades. American University professor Kweku Nwama says Mugabe still has a role in a transition.
The people that have influence over him should remind him that his legacy is at stake. He should make sure that the process moves on smoothly without violence, because it can also slide into violence quickly.
Nwama says the process needs to be inclusive.
Civil society, opposition, religious groups, the youth, everybody has to get involved. The Western powers who have imposed sanctions, they need to get back in, because when you impose sanctions, you lose leverage.
But he says, more importantly, the Zimbabwean leader will need to help guide the creation of the new country, which Nwama says would be a testament to his legacy. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
Well, the top U.S. nuclear commander was quoted as saying Saturday that he would resist President Trump if he ordered an illegal launch of nuclear weapons. CBS News said Air Force General John Hyten, commander of the U.S. Strategic Command, told an audience at the Halifax International Security Forum in Nova Scotia, Canada, that he had given a lot of thought to what he would say if he received such an order. Hyten, who is responsible for overseeing the U.S. nuclear arsenal, explained the process that would follow such a command.
I provide advice to the president. He'll tell me what to do. And if it's illegal, guess what's going to happen? I'm going to say, Mr. President, that's illegal. And guess what he's going to do? He's going to say, what would be legal? And we'll come up with options of a mix of capabilities to respond to whatever the situation is. And that's the way it works.
Hyten said running through scenarios of how to react in the event of an illegal order is standard practice. The issue came up after questions by U.S. senators, including Democrats and Trump's fellow Republicans, about Trump's authority to wage war, use nuclear weapons, and enter into or end international agreements amid concern that tensions over North Korea's nuclear and missile programs could further lead to hostilities. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Britain accuses Russia of the Brexit vote meddling as new evidence emerges. Foul weather slows the search for a missing Argentine sub with 44 on board. Experts say extremism can be fought by involving civil societies. And police question the Israeli leader over corruption allegations. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com. And on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. A powerful magnitude 7.0 earthquake near the French territory of New Caledonia in the South Pacific has triggered a tsunami warning. VOA's Victor Beatty gets details from Australia geosciences seismologist Doran Ionescu.
It's one of quite a number of earthquakes that we recorded in this area over the past weeks. And the actual magnitude as measured by us is more like 7.2. And we had also generation of small tsunami waves. It was a very shallow earthquake. And we had tsunami waves of up to 1 meter measured on the eastern coast of the island facing the earthquake from North Caledonia.
Was this the most powerful of these recent earthquakes?
That's correct. That was the most powerful. We had quite a number, you know, including yesterday. So ranging, you know, everything, 5.5 to this one, which we had as a 7.2. So that was a bit, perhaps unexpected in terms. It's certainly not an aftershock as such. It's more mainly related to probably likely redistribution of stress along the faults in that area. And as such, you know, it was larger than prior earthquakes, which were recorded within the last couple of weeks. Now, subsequently, we had actually further 3 aftershocks following this event. So they came within a few minutes, up to 1 hour. So it's a very shaky period of time in that region.
If this had been a deeper earthquake under the water, would the tsunami likely have been larger?
So typically, likelihood for tsunami is for shallow earthquakes, not for deep earthquakes. So regarding depth, that's a quite dangerous earthquake, potentially. And as such, you know, we also recorded, as I said, tsunami waves of over 0.5 meters.
Doran, is this New Caledonia and this area on the so-called Ring of Fire?
Yes. So, in fact, the Ring of Fire is not directly above, but, you know, it's like within a few hundreds of kilometers of the Ring of Fire, and as such, it's highly affected by such events. Many events in that area, particularly in that period of time.
That's Australia geoscientist seismologist Doran Ionescu. Well, an inquiry in Australia is recommending the closure of a youth detention center involved in an abuse scandal that shocked the nation. Images of inmates being mistreated, including one teenage boy who was restrained and placed in a spit hood, were shown last year from Sydney, from Phil Mercer reports.
Last year, a TV documentary showed images of young detainees being tear-gassed and strip-searched in youth detention facilities in Australia's Northern Territory. The scandal prompted the authorities to set up a Royal Commission, the highest form of inquiry in Australia. Its final report contains more than 2,500 pages and demands sweeping changes to address the shocking and systemic failures in the territory's youth justice system. A teenage detainee told the investigating team that he'd been deprived of food, repeatedly strip-searched, and stopped from using a toilet during his detention. He said he was forced to defecate into a pillowcase. The report said that the system's failures had happened over many years and were known and ignored at the highest levels. Northern Territory Chief Minister Michael Gunner is promising to act on the proposals.
I am sorry of the stories that will live on in those children who are in our care, children that we have failed, because our youth justice and child protection systems are supposed to make our kids better, not break them.
The report calls for an end to detention for children aged under 14 in the Northern Territory, prohibiting the use of tear gas and force on child inmates, and a move away from punishment to therapy and rehabilitation. The Northern Territory's notorious Don Dale Youth Detention Centre, where much of the mistreatment of child inmates took place, should also be closed, the report says. Margaret White, one of the commissioners, says more humane alternative accommodation should take its place.
The point must be met that there will be some young people who must be kept in secure detention, either because of the extreme seriousness of the crimes that they commit or because of their own complex needs. And we've recommended a small, secure facility. We don't want any more than 12 beds in any one facility.
Most of the teenage inmates in the Northern Territory are Aboriginal Australians, who are significantly overrepresented in the justice system. The children who are tear-gassed have said they feared for their lives and still suffer disturbing flashbacks and nightmares. Lawyers said detaining children in isolation was also a clear violation of the United Nations Convention Against Torture. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, Managing Editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. British primatologist and UN messenger of peace Dr. Jane Goodall is considered to be one of the world's foremost experts on chimpanzees. She's best known for her study of social and family interactions of wild chimpanzees in Gombe Stream National Park, Tanzania. She had to be convinced by National Geographic recently that there was a reason to do yet another documentary about her life and work. But now she feels it's the most authentic, moving portrait to date. The film uses never-before-seen footage that was thought to have been lost. The film takes viewers into the forest as Goodall's groundbreaking observations of wild chimpanzees challenge human uniqueness.
It had long been thought that we were the only creatures on Earth that used and made tools.
Goodall says watching Flo, a mother chimpanzee, interacting with her young offspring was another defining part of her research.
She was all the things that a chimp mother should be. She was protective, but not overprotective. She was affectionate, she was playful, but being supportive, that was the key. And of course, that's what my mother was. She supported me.
The documentary, Jane, has received critical acclaim. I had a chance to speak with Dr. Jane Goodall recently as she visited Washington for a premiere showing of the film. At the end of the film, when you talked about human beings' responsibility for the thoughtless behaviors of our species and need the need to show the next generation better stewardship, what can we do to reverse the trend of this lack of understanding and importance, to realize that this interconnectedness between the environment and the animals is crucial to our own existence and the planet? And do you think that the film accomplishes any of that?
Well, I'm not sure about that. It wasn't created to do that. You know, we, the Jane Goodall Institute, is working with our Roots and Shoots program specifically on that kind of question. And whether or not the film accomplishes it, I haven't actually ever thought about it because it wasn't created for that purpose. But I definitely think, well, people have told me that the intimate picture of me out in the forest with the chimpanzees and talking about the beauty of nature and the interconnectedness, I think a lot of people will get that.
Do you think that ultimately we can reverse the trend?
Well, we won't obviously be able to reverse it with everybody, but our Roots and Shoots program is now in 100 countries with about 100,000 active groups, and a group can be a whole school. And we've also got an awful lot of people who've been through the program, which began in 91, who say that they look on the environment differently.
The human population since 1992 has dramatically increased, about 35%. Nearly 29% of animals are on the decline now on this planet. Are you fearful of the survival of your beloved chimps? And how do you stay hopeful?
Well, it's partly because the amazing human brain is always creating new technologies, and we don't know what is going to come up as we are faced with a greater and greater challenge. It does depend a little bit on the various administrations around the world as to how quickly this can happen. But also, you know, nature is amazingly resilient. So all around Gombe in the early 90s, the hills were bare, and now they're all covered again in forest because we worked with the local people and they set land aside. And then, you know, everywhere I go, there I meet the most incredible people doing amazing things, things which a while back might have been thought impossible, like restoring nature to areas that we have totally destroyed, like quarries that are made by people, you know, mining for cement. And a huge quarry was restored to beauty, and the animals came back, and a stream came back. So, and animals have been rescued from the brink of extinction and given another chance. And the young people, I mean, you know, everywhere I go, there are young people with shining eyes wanting to tell Dr. Jane what they're doing, what they've been doing, what they plan to do to make the world better for people, for animals, for the environment.
So that stewardship is what's going to save the human race, I imagine. You see it all over, sort of a transition happening with the way we look at animals. Are you at all concerned by the current administration's environmental policies and they're reversing a ban on elephant trophies from Africa? Do these kinds
of
things?
You hardly need ask me that question if you know the answer. I mean, of course, I'm deeply concerned. And it's very much the same in the UK. It's the same in Australia. And there's this.
What do we do?
Well, we have to lobby. I mean, right now I'm involved in lobbying to prevent drilling in the Arctic Refuge. I've written a letter to congressmen and senators and spoken to some of them. We just have to make our voices heard. And I think one thing is interesting, that social media, although it can be used to really bad purposes, nevertheless, we now have a way of bringing voices together from all around the world. People who care about a particular issue, whether it's climate change or trophy hunting or whatever it happens.
What can humans learn from what you've learned about chimps?
Well, I think it sort of kind of almost works the other way around. We learn that chimpanzees are so like us biologically. You know, we only differ by 1.6% of our DNA structure. And then the behavior, kissing, embracing, using tools, having a culture, having good mothers and bad mothers, we learn all that. So it certainly breaks down any perceived barrier between humans and non-humans, which is what was thought when I went to Cambridge back in 1962. I was taught that there was a difference in kind between humans and other animals, and that I couldn't talk about chimp personalities or minds or emotions. But, you know, luckily, my dog had taught me that that wasn't true when I was a child. Mm-hmm. And so I prevailed, and, you know, now you can study animal personality and mind and emotion. So I think now that we understand how close we are to chimps in so many ways, it helps us to think of how we're different. Because you need that closeness. And then you realize, well, we're very close, but we're certainly different. And so what is the main difference? I think it's the explosive development of our intellect, which makes it absurd that being the most intellectual being on the planet, we are destroying our only home. It's crazy. Just for greed. We're caught up in this materialistic society which bases success on how much money you make, how much power you have.
We need to turn that intellectual superiority in a way that does good, I hear you saying.
Absolutely. And this is what our Roots and Shoots kids are, you know, that's the young people that are the real hope for the future. They really are changing. We have our youth leadership councils. We've got young volunteers from university going into primary schools and secondary school sometimes and spreading the program. And when young people know the problem and that we listen to their voices and empower them to take action, they just, you know, they roll up their sleeves and they get out there, and it's incredible what they're doing.
I imagine you will continue to work till your last breath. That would be my assumption. What do you see for your future? What do you still want to achieve?
I think if you're talking about goals, the higher you aim, the higher you're likely to get. So the aim is to create a critical mass of young people who understand that, yes, we need money to live. It goes wrong when we live for money. Young people who understand the need to be respectful of animals and nature. And I will go on traveling around the world and growing this program for youth to give them hope, because if we lose hope, then that's the end, because if you don't have hope, there's no point doing anything. So that's what I plan to do. But of course, I have not the remotest idea how long my body will continue to function. None of us know, do we?
No. And it's interesting that you said in the film that you don't spend more than three weeks in any one place. Do you still visit the chimps, and do you not miss just being with them? And does this generation know you?
Of chimps, no, they don't, and I don't know them. I get back twice a year to Gombe, but only for a couple of days at a time. I don't even try to pick up any threads. But, you know, I have all those memories, and nothing can take them away. And this film brings it back so vividly, those best days of my life.
So lucky that you are able to look back on your life like that it was documented that way. I can't even imagine what that must feel like, to have the privilege of being in their presence.
Well, It was so amazing, you know, gradually getting to know them with all their vivid personalities and quirks of behavior and good mothers and bad mothers and intelligent males and less intelligent ones, all of that. So they were amazing times. You know, right now, Gombe is very steep, rugged, and I'm nearly 84, and it's not sensible to go climbing up to the tops of the peak, even if I was there long enough to do it. But I've had all those days. I mean, I couldn't have been more lucky, could I?
I think that you're, you know, to many people, just a hero for all the wonderful work you've done and the awareness that you've brought. And all the best to you, and thank you for everything that you've done.
Well, thank you very much, and it was lovely talking to you.
And by the way, since this interview and following widespread condemnation for his decision to overturn a ban on big game animal trophy imports to the U.S., President Donald Trump says he's putting the decision on hold until he can review all conservation facts. And finally, Malcolm Young, the founder of rock band AC/DC, has died Saturday at the age of 64. He created the Australian heavy metal band with his brother Angus in 1972. He was the group's guitar player until April of 2014. When he took leave of the band, it was later announced that he'd been suffering from dementia. AC/DC was known for its bold guitar riffs and declarative howling vocals, characterized by such strong songs as Back in Black and Highway to Hell. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
2.5 years into the Syrian civil war, the Syrian government attacked its own people with chemical weapons. On August 21, 2013, rockets delivering deadly sarin gas landed in Ghouta, a rebel-controlled suburb of Damascus. It is not clear how many people died. Estimates vary from just under 300 people to over 1,700. But what is clear beyond the shadow of a doubt is that this atrocity was perpetrated by order of the regime of Bashar al-Assad. There is evidence that the Syrian government had used chemical weapons against its own people prior to the Ghouta attack as well as after August 2013. Thus, to hold the responsible parties accountable for these murders, in August 2015, the United Nations Security Council passed Resolution 2235. It established the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons and United Nations Joint Investigative Mechanism, or JIM, in order to assign responsibility for these attacks. On October 26th, this independent international body reported that it is confident that the Syrian Arab Republic is responsible for the release of sarin gas in Khan Sheikhoun on the 4th of April, 2017. Such use would constitute a clear violation of international law, including the Chemical Weapons Convention. The JIM also found that the terrorist group ISIS perpetrated a sulfur mustard attack on the town of Umm Hush on two consecutive days in September 2016. In a November 8th joint statement, U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, British Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson, French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian, and German Foreign Minister Sigmar Gabriel condemned both attacks. They demanded that the Syrian regime immediately cease all use of chemical weapons and that the Assad regime finally declare to the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons all chemical weapons that it possesses. A robust international response is now essential to hold those responsible to account, seek justice for the victims of these abhorrent attacks, and to prevent such attacks from happening again, the statement continues. After such a report, the Security Council and all its members have a common responsibility to protect the international non-proliferation regime and live up to their previous commitments.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.